From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the secret revolution behind South Africa's elections. During Nelson Mandela's last years of imprisonment, he had a series of secret meetings with members of the government, which led to Mandela's release and the unbanning of black political groups. We'll talk with Alistair Sparks, the South African journalist who revealed the story. Also today, Selling God. We talk with historian Lawrence Moore about the marketing of American religion from 19th century revival meetings to the televangelists. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Backbeat, the new movie about the early days of the Beatles. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The House of Representatives has passed a $28 billion crime package. It would put 50,000 new police officers on the street and imprison for life felons who commit three violent crimes. The House bill would let defendants given the death penalty use racial statistics to show racial bias to avoid being executed. And Representative William Hughes has sponsored an amendment that makes the possession and trafficking of crack cocaine the same as powder cocaine. Hughes says sentencing has been tougher on crack users.
It's interesting that about 95% of those that are charged with crack cocaine violations are black and other minorities. Compared to powdered cocaine, which are used by the more affluent in our society. I think most people understand that it's a gross inequity and we need to rectify it.
The House must now reconcile its crime bill with a Senate version that was adopted last November. Aid workers in Garajda say the Bosnian Serbs are still attacking a hospital there. At least 20 people died today when two Serbian rockets fell on a hospital annex. A doctor says another mortar shell hit a neighboring building, killing another five. NPR's Andy Bowers is in Sarajevo. He says the shelling hasn't let up.
Reports from aid workers say the shelling has continued as heavily as ever. A makeshift medical center outside the main hospital was hit today. At least 28 people were killed in that. There have been many other attacks, and some reports put the number of dead just in the last 24 hours at up to 100, but those are unconfirmed reports.
A company of 100 United Nations peacekeepers and 41 medics was allowed to travel toward Garajda today, but a UN spokesman says the convoy was blocked about 18 miles from Garajda by a group of women and children. Secretary of State Warren Christopher says the Bosnian war is threatening all of Europe. He's told members of Congress that the U.S. and its allies must consider stronger airstrikes against the Bosnian Serbs. Christopher says strong action needs to be used in Garajda or else the fighting will spread. Senate Armed Services Committee Chairman Sam Nunn says he supports stepped-up airstrikes, but he's warning it might not be enough and it could mean American casualties. Germany and Great Britain are supporting President Clinton's call for more airstrikes. The British Foreign Secretary says air power can help protect the Bosnian Muslims' safe areas. The German Chancellor says President Clinton's call is a decisive stand. But Russia is rejecting more airstrikes. Moscow says previous air raids have just made matters worse. The president is supported, however, by both congressional Republicans and Democrats. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average has risen more than 49 points to 3,648. Trading is extremely heavy. The Nasdaq is up 12. This is NPR. Hospital officials in New York say former President Richard Nixon has slipped into a deep coma 3 days after suffering a major stroke. From member station WNYC, Dick Hinchliffe reports.
A statement released by New York Hospital says Mr. Nixon is resting comfortably, but the coma is a sign of further deterioration in his medical condition. In the hours after his stroke Monday evening, the 81-year-old Nixon was described as unable to speak and paralyzed on most of his right side. Late yesterday, officials said he was groggy. Prior to the coma, Nixon was being treated for swelling of the brain, a potentially fatal complication for stroke victims. Doctors were reportedly abiding by Mr. Nixon's previously stated wishes not to use a respirator to speed up his breathing. Mr. Nixon's family members, including daughters Tricia Cox and Julie Eisenhower, are at his bedside during this period that doctors called the critical hours after the stroke. In the past few days, get-well messages have inundated Mr. Nixon's New Jersey office and his presidential library in Southern California. For National Public Radio, I'm Dick Hinchliffe in New York.
Houston officials say at least 14 people are being treated for breathing problems following a chemical leak at the Johnson Space Center. Officials say nitrogen tetroxide, which is used in shuttle engine fuel, was accidentally released from a storage facility. The release created a reddish cloud that rose about 400 feet above the Space Center, and it quickly dissipated. A published report says investigators have reportedly found that systems that could have averted last week's downing of two U.S. helicopters in northern Iraq were shut off. The Washington Times is citing a Pentagon source who says the switches on the friend or foe identification system were off. The Times says the findings are preliminary and that the crash could have jolted the switches off. But the Times cites other sources who say the helicopter pilots might have turned off the units, thinking that their only threat was from Iraqi planes. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News, in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. There are secret negotiations that paved the way for next week's first democratic election in South Africa. During Nelson Mandela's last 4 years of imprisonment, he had a series of secret meetings with the Minister of Prisons and members of the South African government, including President Botha. Those talks led to Mandela's release and to the unbanning of black political groups. My guest Alistair Sparks uncovered the story and wrote about it in a recent edition of The New Yorker. It's also the subject of his forthcoming book, tentatively titled The Secret Revolution. Sparks is one of South Africa's foremost journalists. Mandela was such an admirer of Sparks' journalism that he gave Sparks the first interview after his release from prison. They ended up doing a series of interviews in which the story of the secret talks emerged. We called Sparks in Johannesburg earlier today and asked him why the government held secret talks with Mandela.
In the 80s, South Africa was under intense and mounting pressure on all fronts. Economic pressure, pressure from domestic unrest in the black townships, and diplomatic pressure from the Western countries, many of whom were demanding as a sort of priority sign of goodwill that Nelson Mandela should be released after his unconscionable length of time in prison. So President Botha was casting about, looking for a way to get off this hook, to release his embarrassing prisoner, but to do so in a way that would not get him into political trouble at home.
Why were these secret talks kept secret?
Oh, precisely because their disclosure would have been politically embarrassing to Botha. President Botha was a hawk. He was a hardliner. He had introduced some changes. He'd made some concessions in the face of this mounting domestic and international pressure, but his intention was to retain white control and ultimate white power. And of course, he was looking after his own constituency, and the last thing he felt he could afford was to let it be known that he was talking to the man that he had demonized as a terrorist and who was being kept in prison for the safety of the state. If it became known that he was having secret talks or that his ministers were having secret talks with Nelson Mandela, it would have backfired terribly, both on his policy of demonization of the black nationalist movement, and indeed it would have unsettled his own constituency very seriously.
Did Mandela also want the talks to remain secret?
Yes, he did. He has confessed that he did. He, too, was worried that without being able to explain his motives, that his own movement in exile would wonder what on earth was going on if it became known that he was talking to the apartheid government. There had been a long history in South Africa of black leaders being turned, well, not so much leaders, but members of the ANC being turned under interrogation or after lengthy imprisonment. And he was worried that deep suspicions would arise if it became known that he was talking to the government. If he'd had an opportunity to explain to his followers in exile what his intentions were, then it would have been fine. But he had no such opportunity because he was in prison and all means of communication were cut off for him.
So during these talks, the government really wanted to just kind of work out a deal where they could get Mandela out of prison and end the embarrassment of keeping him there. But Mandela wanted to end apartheid through negotiations. Did the government make Mandela deals, offers where they could get him out of prison in return for something that he'd give?
Yes, they kept making offers to him, all of which were offers he refused to accept.
What kinds of offers?
One of the offers was conditional on him renouncing the use of violence. And while that might sound perfectly reasonable on the face of it, it in fact would have required him to renounce the whole underground activity of his organization that had been going on throughout his period of imprisonment. He had started the guerrilla movement. He started it only when his organization was outlawed. He'd been committed to peaceful campaigning up to that point, but when his organization was declared illegal and was unable to pursue his objectives, he then took the decision, or rather the movement took the decision, that the only way to pursue the struggle in those circumstances would be by way of launching an underground guerrilla struggle, which initially was aimed only at installations and inanimate targets and was intent on trying to avoid loss of life. That commitment became blurred later on. But there was no way that Mandela was going to renounce the very cause for his imprisonment, which eventually lasted 27 years. So it that one got refused. Another was conditional on him returning silently to the tribal homeland that had been established for his particular ethnic group under the apartheid system. So he was told he could go quietly and comfortably back home, and if he sat there silently, all would be forgotten. Well, that too, for such a feisty campaigner, was unacceptable. So these various offers kept coming his way, but he stuck very stubbornly to his basic commitment that he would never leave prison unless it was to go to a negotiating table.
He did leave prison for short intervals to go for negotiations with representatives of the government. What kinds of places did they meet him in, and how did they secretly get Mandela from prison to these secret meeting places?
Well, the overriding concern in President Botha's mind through all these 4 years of secret discussions was that news of it should not leak out, because that would be so politically embarrassing. Therefore, they moved him from the main political prison of Robben Island onto the mainland, because, of course, they couldn't send senior government officials frequently out to the island prison without this being noticed. And then they didn't want to hold the meetings within the prison itself, because once again these high officials of the government would be seen arriving there, and this would arouse suspicion and lead to rumor and eventually, of course, leaks. And so they went to great lengths meeting with him in a guest house on the far side of the prison grounds. He went to the Minister of Prisons' home on several occasions and sat in his sitting room. And then he fell ill, which provided the initial opportunity for the Minister of Prisons to see him, because he visited him in the hospital, and that is when the discussions began. Subsequently, on his return to the prison, on the pretext of keeping a close watch on his health, they kept him in the hospital section of the prison, and that made it much easier for them to fetch him out and take him to these various meeting places without anyone noticing. And that, of course, included the prison staff, except for the commanding officer of the prison and his deputy, and one or two trusted warders. The rest of the prison staff were kept in the dark about these mysterious comings and goings of the world's number one prisoner, you know, and it went on for more than 4 years.
In 1988, the government decided to start planning for Mandela's eventual release. What was the turning point that made the government decide they would release Mandela?
Well, I don't think there was a decision until President Botha suffered a stroke and was removed from office. He didn't go voluntarily, he had to be pushed. But when he left, the new president, F.W. de Klerk, our present incumbent, came into office. He came, surprisingly, from the right wing of the party, and then took everybody by surprise by doing what Botha had shrunk from doing all these years. He had his own meetings with Mandela, and then decided, because the South African situation was deteriorating, the economy was deteriorating, the security situation was deteriorating, but none of it fatally, let me emphasize that. But he took the long view. He realized that the country was in a dead-end street. The government was in a dead-end street, rather, and that something would have to be done in the long run. And he decided then that better act now rather than wait until the position of the present ruling oligarchy was weakened even further and its negotiating position was weakened accordingly. Rather move rapidly and dramatically. And at that point, he decided to take Mandela at his word. And that is when de Klerk, on the 2nd of February 1990, took the world and even his own supporters by surprise by making the sweeping announcement of lifting the restriction orders, the banning orders, on all black political movements, announcing the release of Mandela and other political prisoners, and declaring his readiness to enter into negotiations with them.
You were at that speech. Were you shocked?
Well, I wasn't shocked. I was delighted, but I was certainly surprised. We had all expected him to make an announcement of some sort, a reformist announcement. But I don't think anybody there imagined for a moment that he'd go as far as he did. Certainly not that he'd do it in one fell swoop, you know, with such a blockbuster speech. But that was a tactical decision on his part. He decided that if he was going to do it, then the way to do it was to do it all at once and sort of capture the moral high ground, take everybody by surprise, throw the black nationalist movement off balance by the sheer scale of what he'd done, and get himself into a commanding position that way. It was a very shrewd tactical decision. He's a very clever politician.
After that speech, Mandela was released just a few days later, I believe.
1 week, yes.
Yeah, but the government had been preparing Mandela for release for a while before that. How did they prepare him for that?
Well, not so much the government as the Minister of Prisons, who had been meeting him all this time and had got to know him. And, you know, personal relations develop when these discussions take place and go on and on and on over all these years. And the Minister of Prisons had passed the word down that, you know, he wanted this prisoner to be treated in a more humane fashion, and he believed he would eventually have to be released and so should be prepared psychologically for that. He was worried about the psychological impact of releasing somebody who'd been in jail for so long, half his adult life. And so very quietly the word was sent down that it might be a good idea to take him for a few drives and a couple of excursions. So this began, and they began driving him around the countryside and showing him things. This got bolder and bolder to the point where he was taken for a walk on a beach.
Nobody recognized
him? One of the young warders even took him to his home and introduced him to his family.
But, you know, Nelson Mandela was such a famous prisoner. Didn't people recognize him?
No, nobody knew what he looked like because under the South African prisons laws, no photograph of any prisoner may be published. Nor, in the case of a political prisoner, of a banned organization, could any word that he uttered be reprinted or uttered anywhere. So he was silenced and wiped from view, and nobody knew what he looked like. He was even taken into some fast food joints in towns not far from the prison where he was being kept, and of course nobody knew who he was. He spoke to gas station attendants when his prison minders, all of whom of course were dressed in civilian clothing, were filling up their car, and they didn't know who he was.
My guest is South African journalist Alistair Sparks, the author of a forthcoming book on the secret negotiations between the South African government and Mandela that led to Mandela's release from prison. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. Back with South African journalist Alistair Sparks, who's joining us from Johannesburg. When de Klerk announced that he would unban black political organizations and release Nelson Mandela from prison, do you think he had any idea what he was setting in motion?
I think de Klerk had a particular, very specific idea in mind. He wanted to introduce quite dramatic reforms, but he wanted to do them in such a way that the white minority, while maybe not retaining power, would at least retain a veto power and would be able to prevent any significant restructuring of the political order here. He had worked out a very detailed program that he had in mind, as happened in the case of Mikhail Gorbachev when he announced perestroika, I don't think he realized at that time that when you begin introducing changes like this, you unleash new forces that develop a dynamic of their own and propel you far beyond where you originally intended to go. And I think the distinguishing thing about de Klerk in pursuing the comparison with Gorbachev is that whereas Gorbachev tried to freeze the process, tried to stick with his limited perestroika, de Klerk didn't. De Klerk had the pragmatic intelligence, I would say, to stay with the changes as the pressures he had unleashed began propelling the whole process forward. He didn't try to stop it. He realized that he had unleashed an unstoppable movement, and he stayed with it. The result is that while there will be, as part of the compromise coming out of the negotiations, there will be a government of national unity involving all parties for the first 5 years after next week's election. At the end of those 5 years, there will be a full, normal majority rule, which de Klerk, when he made his announcement in 1990, declared that he was still strenuously opposed to.
South African journalist Alistair Sparks is my guest. He's speaking to us from Johannesburg. How does the story of this secret set of negotiations, the subject of your forthcoming book, how does this story change the history of the end of apartheid?
Well, I think it's been an astonishing process in itself that a country with no history of interracial negotiation or dialogue even, an authoritarian country, a country with very little in the way of a democratic tradition of interacting across the color line, did in this strange way get involved in face-to-face discussion. And I think that discussion worked its own chemistry. And this in itself, I think, is an astonishing process, as far as I'm aware, unprecedented anywhere else, that such a large group of political parties of such great racial and political and ideological disparity could reach that level of agreement domestically I mean, there has been no United Nations brokerage. There's been no Vance Owen plan. There's been no handshake of old adversaries on the White House lawn or anything like that. These people have done it themselves. They've chaired their own meetings, and it has gone on and on and on for 4 years. And now we've reached the point where this domestically agreed constitution and transitional process is taking place. It's leading to an election next week, which will change the government. It will change from being a white minority government to a black majority government. And you see, admitting black South Africans to full citizenship was not like the Civil Rights Act in the United States. This wasn't simply admitting a minority group to the mainstream of society. It was handing over the country to other people to run, and for the present governors to become the future minority group. Now, that hasn't happened very often in history.
What has it been like for you to watch Nelson Mandela campaigning for president?
Fascinating. I mean, the man fascinates me all the way around. I'm absolutely enthralled by somebody who can step out of prison after 27 years, pretty harsh years too, imprisoned for his political beliefs, imprisoned because of his race, and show not one grain of racial bitterness. I find that extraordinary. I don't believe I could possibly have restrain my sense of bitterness had I undergone such an experience. So I find that in itself makes him an extraordinary personality. He gives the impression of being somebody who was locked away for a long, long time and who now has a lot of living to catch up. He also gives the impression of being aware and having been aware for a long time that he was a man of destiny, that there was something that he was born to do. This really is the impression I get from him, that he's always known that this moment would come.
Have you been following de Klerk at all as he campaigns?
Oh, yes. De Klerk is campaigning very vigorously indeed.
Have you been watching him campaign in black townships?
Yes. He's campaigning in black townships, in the mixed-race townships, Asian townships, everywhere. He has to do that because, of course, the white population is a minority here. There are only 5 million whites in a population of 41 million. So if you want to get anywhere in politics now that it's been democratized, you have to get out there if you're a white leader, and you have to campaign in the black townships. Now, that's not the easiest thing in the world. If you've been identified with apartheid all your life.
What are your plans for Election Day? What will you be doing?
Well, I shall be reporting it as best I can. I shall vote, of course. That will be very exciting, to participate in South Africa's first democratic elections. I'm now 61 years old, I have never seen a government change at the ballot box in my adult life. And I'm going to see that happen next week, and that will be very exciting indeed. I shall take great delight in moving around as much as I can and just witnessing as much as I can of this extraordinary event. I mean, for me, this is like Buzz Aldrin and Armstrong landing on the moon.
Alistair Sparks is the head of the Institute for the Advancement of Journalism in Johannesburg. His forthcoming book is tentatively titled The Secret Revolution, which is also the title of his article in the April 11th edition of The New Yorker. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, religious leaders as entrepreneurs. We talk with Lawrence Moore about the marketing of religion. It's the subject of his new book, Selling God, American Religion in the Marketplace of Culture. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Backbeat, the new movie about the early days of the Beatles. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Shelling has been reported throughout the day in the Bosnian Muslim town of Garajda. As many as 28 people have reportedly died in a rocket attack on a makeshift medical center. Kathy Jenkins reports for the BBC.
This time the target was a building near to the hospital, an overflow for patients who couldn't be fitted into the main building itself. There were two tank rounds, according to aid workers. The first destroyed the protective sandbags, the second blasted inside. More than 400 people are known to have been killed in the three-week Serb offensive, but the death toll is rising by the hour. The Bosnian government says it has been given an ultimatum by the local Bosnian Serb commander to either agree to the terms of a ceasefire proposed by the Serbs or see the town and its civilians flattened by Serb guns. The Bosnian Prime Minister, Haris Salajic, said he had written immediately to the UN Security Council to inform it of the ultimatum. It is outrageous. Of course, we cannot comply with it, he said.
Kathy Jenkins reporting. A spokesman for the ruling Japanese coalition says the group has agreed on a common policy platform. This clears the way for the selection of a new prime minister. The ruling coalition has been unable to choose a new leader since outgoing Premier Morihiro Hosokawa announced his resignation 2 weeks ago. Leaders of the ruling party will meet tomorrow afternoon to nominate their candidate for prime minister. Foreign Minister Tsutomu Hata is widely expected to succeed Hosokawa. A federal report says restricting smoking in public could save up to $72 billion every year. The Environmental Protection Agency has looked at the net savings in a bill that wants to restrict such smoking. The EPA says the saved money will come from stopping premature deaths and cutting illnesses in children. EPA Administrator Carol Browner is supporting the legislation.
Smoking restrictions would reduce premature deaths among non-smokers. It would improve the health of all Americans, but particularly the health of children, resulting in fewer cases of respiratory illness, ear infections, and asthma. And it would save businesses billions of dollars in reduced building operations.
The legislation is sponsored by Congressman Henry Waxman of California. The second phase of Rodney King's lawsuit against the city of Los Angeles has begun. The jury's already awarded King nearly $4 million in compensatory damages for a beating he suffered by city police 3 years ago. Now King wants punitive damages. 14 defendants are accused of contributing to violating King's civil rights, including the officers who beat him and former L.A. police chief Daryl Gates. Stock prices soared today on Wall Street. The Dow Industrials gained almost 54 points to close at 3,652. This is NPR. The International Atomic Energy Agency says North Korea has told it international weapons inspectors can watch the refueling of one of its nuclear reactors. An IAEA spokesman says this inspection is vital to clearing up charges that North Korea is developing nuclear weapons. The agency says it has responded positively to this offer. Opening statements began today in the Detroit trial of Dr. Jack Kevorkian. He is accused of violating Michigan's law banning assisted suicides. Don Gagne reports from Detroit.
Kevorkian is charged under a Michigan law making it a felony punishable by up to 4 years in prison to help another person take their own life. This case revolves around the suicide last August of a 30-year-old man suffering from Lou Gehrig's disease. Kevorkian has admitted helping the man die. The cause of death was carbon monoxide poisoning. This morning, Kevorkian made his way through a crowd of journalists as he arrived at the downtown Detroit courthouse. When asked his thoughts about the trial, he angrily replied, "What trial? This is the Spanish Inquisition." Kevorkian's attorneys will attempt to convince the jury that Michigan's ban on assisted suicide is unconstitutional. Prosecutors will stress that Kevorkian, and not the law, is on trial. For National Public Radio, this is Don Gagne in Detroit.
The government says weekly unemployment claims rose unexpectedly for the third consecutive week. The Labor Department says they were up 14,000 for the week ended April 16th. Most economists had predicted a decline of about 10,000. The International Committee of the Red Cross says hundreds of thousands of people may be dead in Rwanda. Agency officials say the human tragedy is on a scale hardly ever seen before. They say the exact number may never be known, and the fighting hasn't let up. There's still combat in Kigali, the Rwandan capital. Thousands of bodies are rotting in the streets. Relief workers warn conditions are ripe for epidemic. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Religions in America have learned a lot from advertising and pop culture. We have religious bumper stickers, ashtrays, TV and radio programs, pop records, and theme parks. The marketing of American religion is the subject of the new book, Selling God, by Lawrence Moore. He's a professor of history at Cornell University. He told me why he's studying religion.
I grew up in Texas. I grew up around religion. I kind of cut my intellectual teeth arguing and debating about religion. I didn't come from a very political family. We didn't argue about politics. My parents didn't reveal how they voted. They thought that was inappropriate. So religion was the subject. And religion was the really important thing. And at a certain point, I suppose, I argued myself out of religion altogether. But the interest of why this is so important in American culture and society. And my general notion is that, okay, religion is a form of organized worship. And we all understand that. It's a way that people come together to worship God. But religion in this culture is so much more than that. It is a diversion. It is a kind of socialization process. It is a social marker to help people in this very pluralistic society identify themselves. It is a way of thinking about politics. It is a vocabulary for politics. We all know that. So that it's just an incredible kind of resource out there.
Well, your new book, Selling God, focuses on the commercialization of some aspects of religion, the marketing of religion, the advertising, the merchandising. Where do you see it starting?
Well, if you took a really long look, I mean, you know, that the notion that religion could be marketed had occurred to Christ. It had occurred to Martin Luther. It is not something that begins with the American story. But for me, it becomes incredibly important in the 19th century because prior to that in this country, that religion had a kind of monopoly on what I would call cultural material. That is, it was which was primarily print material. Preachers were the orators of our society, and they were the authors of our society. And what was disseminated in print form was not exclusively, but largely religious material. In the 19th century, there is an incredible diversification of other things, of different kinds of print material, and then other kinds of entertainments that had not been much around in the colonial period. The theater, various kinds of professional sports. So the market for cultural commodities, if you like, those things we do to improve ourselves or to entertain ourselves, really takes off in the 19th century. Technology makes it possible.
Describe for us what a 19th century revival meeting might have been like and how that fits into the history that you're describing.
Well, I think the important thing about the general shape of 19th century revivals, and they're not nearly, on average, as wild and as tumultuous as we sometimes get depictions of them in the very beginning. In fact, they become fairly early in the 19th rather well-staged events, well-planned events, so that the seating arrangements are set out very carefully, the speaker's platform, rules for how to behave. the emphasis on good order to get the maximum effect. But they are almost, why they are different than, or different from other kinds of religious meetings is they're almost always outdoors so that they can bring together large numbers of people. They last over a period of time. A revival meeting can last a week, and as they become a kind of general summer camp meeting, they can go on for a month. And, you know, you have to bring people together to do something. So obviously there's more going on in a revival meeting than sermons and prayers.
How did the style of oratory change with the revival meeting?
Well, a revivalist has to get people's attention. In the bluntest terms, if you look at many of the styles of colonial ministers or ministers whose sinecure is there because it's fixed, they can preach in a certain manner. They have a captive audience for 2 hours. They can be learned. They can expect a high level of sophistication on the part of the people who hear them. They are not emotional. They can be very dry. The revival preacher is emotional. The revival preacher is like an actor, and that is explicit. You know, Protestants were, in the early part of the 19th century, were by and large enemies of the theater. Whitfield, Finney, other great 19th century American revivalists didn't like theater. But they all said that we have in the pulpit to learn the ways of the actor, because otherwise people will be going to the theater and not coming to the church.
I'm interested in that point that you made, that a lot of the revivalists didn't like the idea of theater, that they thought theater was a kind of dangerous, sinful form of entertainment.
It's a lie. It's a fake.
It's a fake. Okay. But they felt that they should learn from theater and bring some of those techniques to their own preaching.
They should learn, but they shouldn't become fakes. Mm-hmm. Their terrible fear, and of course this was the charge, this is what's going back and forth. The revivalist says, in effect, I can do this because God is behind what I do. I am not a fake. And I don't change my role every night. I don't play Hamlet this night and Iago the next night. I am always what I am, doing God's work. But from the standpoint of the critics of the revival, that the revivalist was just like an actor, dissembling all the time.
My guest is Lawrence Moore. He's the author of the new book, Selling God, American Religion in the Marketplace of Culture. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Back with Lawrence Moore, author of the new book, Selling God. He's a professor of history at Cornell University. Would it be fair to jump ahead to the 20th century and see if there were any comparisons between the revival meetings and the evangelists who preach so effectively on radio and television?
Well, sure, I think it's fair because, I mean, the only difference is that it's now radio and television, that you can use a different kind of medium to reach large audiences.
Where does preaching on radio begin?
In the 20s. The first radio broadcast, this is before network radio, of course, but the first broadcast sermon on anything like a real station was out of Pittsburgh. And it was not an evangelical fundamentalist. I mean, the more liberal Protestants, the more respectable Protestants, if you like, I'm very nervous using that designation, but people who understood, you know, that they were educated and they were they sort of represented a non-divisive kind of theological message. They were the ones who did most of the preaching, and that was certainly true once networks got established. Both radio and television.
When the networks were established, what were their policies about religion on the air?
They would not sell religious times. At least CBS and NBC would not sell time to religion. They would give it away, but they would give it away using the advice of leading Catholic, Jewish, and Protestant organizations, which excluded a lot of what we might call fundamentalist evangelical types. When NBC, the old NBC radio station, was founded, they were in desperate shape for advertisers. So they were willing to sell, at least for a time, radio time.
So the network idea was to use religious programming as a public service and to keep it as much in the mainstream as possible and as ecumenical.
Ecumenical, non-divisive, ennobling, respectable, all those words.
These are the words they would use.
Yes.
So where did the evangelists find their way into broadcasting?
Well, they found it through local stations who had dead time where they couldn't get advertisers, so they would be willing to sell time. These were the local stations. They had a certain amount of flexible time. That this was paid time for them. They didn't have to worry about whether anybody was listening to it or not. They didn't care. And, of course, some of these people could set up their own stations. The Moody Bible Institute could set up a station. They got very good at it because they were the ones who had to compete for an audience. The sort of established face, they had, their time was free. They had a kind of audience. They didn't have to worry about it. It was there. So one of the reasons I think that when television came along, and what you see right now, is that the evangelical groups really were the ones who learned best how to do media, to make it a kind of entertaining program. The other things looked very staid, and they were around in the 50s, but disappeared soon thereafter.
Yeah, you make the point in your book that the National Council of Churches, which got a lot of the public service airtime on the networks, almost had a policy against preaching. They would do, like, dramas and, I guess, discussion shows and things along those lines?
They would do panels. They would do drama. Preaching seemed, for television, their notion was that when television came along, preaching wasn't enough. They were trying to think innovatively about programming.
Mm-hmm.
And to a certain degree, they were successful. But they weren't as good at it, as it turned out, as what we see on television right now. And televangelism is still very powerful and strong, and it's built around preaching.
In 1960, the FCC ruled that radio and TV didn't have to give time to religious groups for public service.
Right.
How did that change the scene for religious programming on television and radio?
Well, by that time, I think something else had happened. There were so many now possibilities of independent stations that, in fact, what many religious leaders, Pat Robertson, Baker, Falwell, did was simply fund their own religious networks and give up on NBC and ABC.
Who do you consider some of the TV preachers who basically, like, defined the form?
Oral Roberts and Jimmy Swaggart.
Why did you choose those two?
Because they were the first. Because in some ways, they were the best at just proving that preaching and emotional preaching was enough to win a large audience of devoted followers. They were taking what had been going on in revival tents and putting it on television in a way that worked to reach large audiences. That's why, to me, they were sort of central to the early story of evangelists on television.
It's funny, in the late 50s and early 60s, I used to watch Oral Roberts, and I'd never seen anything like it in my life. I was a Jewish girl in an apartment building in Brooklyn, New York, and I'd never seen a tent revival like this. And I'd never seen faith healing before. And it was just, it was captivating to me. I mean, it was fascinating.
Well, most people hadn't, even Protestants, even Christians had not seen that kind of activity on television, that it had been a kind of tent show. And most people don't go to tent shows.
You spend a lot of time in Lancaster,
right.
Pennsylvania,
yeah,
for family reasons. And that's the area right around what's called Amish country.
Yes.
Now, the Amish are a group that have resisted all of the manifestations of modern culture. So do you think that they've completely resisted the marketing of religion?
Well, I make the point that if you aren't going to market your religion, somebody's going to do it for you. And what's happened to the Amish in Lancaster County is that they have become a major tourist attraction and advertised as such. It is a tourist draw. It is a way to come to Lancaster, see the Amish, spend your money, visit the Amish farm, visit the Amish restaurant, and shop at all the second stores that line Route 30 flowing east out of Lancaster. So it's a kind of, I guess, final irony that as you resist commercialization, you wind up being a major target of commercial forces. That it's not the Amish that are doing this, but it's just a way of demonstrating just how large and devouring this phenomenon is. It hasn't destroyed the Amish way of life yet.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Lawrence Moore is the author of Selling God, American Religion in the Marketplace of Culture. He's a professor of history at Cornell University. This is Fresh Air. I have a rundown of some of the stories coming up on All Things Considered. The UN is attempting to get a convoy into the besieged city of Garajda as the assault by Bosnian Serbs continues. Secretary of State Warren Christopher will be interviewed about U.S. policy toward Bosnia. Then a discussion of the pros and cons of further military intervention. Also, a musical based on the story of Floyd Collins, who was trapped in a cave in 1925, and a contest to name three newly discovered planets outside our solar system. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Can an actor make an entire career out of playing John Lennon? That's what Ian Hart seems to be doing. He first came to public attention as Lennon in Christopher Munch's film The Hours and the Times. And now he's back in the same role in Ian Softley's debut film, Backbeat. Film critic Stephen Schiff has a review.
Actually, Ian Hart's latest version of John Lennon is the best thing about this movie. If only Lennon had been the main character. But Backbeat is a real oddity. It takes up the early career of the Beatles, the period in 1960 when they were honing their style in the gritty clubs of Hamburg. But instead of focusing on John, Paul, George, and Pete Best, Ringo hadn't joined up yet, the film focuses on John's best friend, Stu Sutcliffe, played here by the American actor Stephen Dorff. Standing still on stage in his sunglasses, Stu was the band's sultry looker, but he really wasn't a musician. His real goal was to be a painter, and it was only John's insistence that made him take up the bass guitar and go through the motions of being the fifth Beatle. Then in Hamburg, lightning struck. A fetching young photographer named Astrid, played by Cheryl Lee, took up the band, and particularly Stu. She fell in love with him and introduced him to the work of Rimbaud and Edith Piaf and to Hamburg's bohemian underground. The movie was based largely on the real-life Astrid's recollections, which means that instead of being about how the Beatles turned their enthusiastic rip-offs of American black music into a rock and roll revolution, it's about the tug-of-war between Astrid and John Lennon for the soul of that hapless pretty boy Stew. Do we believe this movie? Did Astrid really invent the haircut that shook the world? Can we hear Edith Piaf's influence in the Beatles' early ballads? And did Astrid and John really have deep, soulful, late-night discussions like this one?
When your name is in lights and everybody wants to be your friend, and somebody asks you, do you remember Astrid in Hamburg, what will you say?
I'll say she was the girl I always wanted. The girl in me dreams. Like Bridget Bardot with better manners. I might have fallen in love with her. But she fell in love with my best friend. And that was the end of that.
I love him, John. I do.
Yeah. Don't we all?
These goopy exchanges almost sink the movie, but they don't quite succeed because Backbeat manages to be a lot of fun in spite of them. There's lots of raucous stage performance, helped along by an actor named Gary Bakewell, who's an amazing dead ringer for Paul McCartney. And even though the singing voices assembled by soundtrack producer Don Was don't have the penetrating sweetness of the real Lennon and McCartney, director Ian Softley does recreate the combination of boyish rambunctiousness and Liverpudlian cool that made the Beatles so appealing. You can be pretty happy watching this movie, until it starts pulling you back to the artsy troubles of poor old Stu. Stephen Dorff is a reasonably good actor, but Stu's never more than a pawn in a larger game, hence he never moves us. Ian Hart's jumpy, spidery rendition of John Lennon is the thing to see. You could get to like him, even as an ongoing character, let's say in a series of movies like Rocky or Dirty Harry. Or how about Ian Hart in a tuxedo, ordering martinis, shaken and not stirred, while a seductive blonde asks who he is and he replies, Lennon. John Lennon.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for The New Yorker. Fresh Air's senior producer today was Fred Lander. All our interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Nancy Greenlease and Sue Spolin. Research assistance from Louisa Shafia. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Next week, South Africa enters a new era. On the next archive edition of Fresh Air, we look back at life under apartheid. We'll hear from several South Africans, including playwright Ethel Fugard, poet Dennis Brutus, and composer Abdullah Ibrahim. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next archive edition of Fresh Air.